In fact, you are my source for, now these days, whenever I have to do a ref check, I reach out to you saying, Rupali, do you know this?
I took up red bus. My father was very upset.
Not missing those signals have come to, you know, bite me in the back. Somebody gave a feedback in various ways to see how I can improve my own personal productivity. And
you discovered some hack?
Multiple.
I'm going to catch up with you offline. If you could switch your role with anyone in Red Bus for one day, who would that be? Well, I have seen the journey to some extent, Prakash. For our viewers' reference, would be glad to know at what scale Redbus operates today.
Yeah, so Redbus is a 17-year-old organization now. And like if you look at the last financial year for which we had put out the results, we had done on the bus ticketing side, we sold about 87 million travel tickets.
Globally? Now, or
globally.
Okay.
Globally.
Okay.
And Redbus now is a part of the Make My Trip group.
Yes.
Right. So in the Make My Trip group, we've got various ground transportation units. From a brand standpoint, Redbus is the leading brand, which is into intercity buses. And that is what I was saying, 87 million travel tickets last year. In the first quarter, the numbers have obviously grown. It's about 27 million in the first quarter.
Okay.
Which translates to about 292,000 seats on a daily basis. Right. And just a few days ago, which was the Sunday following Dashara, you were mentioning about your return back to Bangalore and how crowded it was.
Yes.
I think a lot of people had similar ideas. A lot of people were traveling.
Yes.
And that day we posted a record high, wherein for the very first time, we crossed 400,000 booked seats for that day of journey.
Yes.
Right. Apart from bus ticketing, we also do train tickets. Yeah. We are authorized partners for IRCTC. And apart from train ticketing, we do railway, rail MIS, as we call it, RIS, sorry, which is Railway Information Services, which includes information around PNR status, live train status, all of that.
Okay.
Beyond that, we've also ventured into the intercity cabs market.
Yeah.
We recently acquired a majority position in Sawari.
Okay.
Which is a brand in the
congratulations.
Outstation intercity space.
Yes.
And that is our business in India. But beyond this, we are also present in markets outside of India. Southeast Asia primarily, wherein we are present in Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia. And very recently in Vietnam and Colombia, in Cambodia.
Yeah.
And we also have a couple of countries that we cover in Latin America. Which is Peru and Colombia.
Okay, okay. Wonderful. But what's the headcount like now?
We're close to about 1,000 people.
Okay, that's a lean team for the size of operation that you've had.
Yeah. And of that, about 100 odd people are outside of India. So in India, we have about 900 odd.
900 odd. Okay, okay, great. Okay. I remember the international expansion journey at that point in time. And I'm glad to see that Vietnam has reopened.
Yeah.
Lovely. Prakash, I did some research while I've known you for a while. I did and I did some research, right? And I read somewhere that at the age of 20, your ambition was to be a business leader, right? And you've been a CEO for over a decade now, right? How has that dream to the reality? How has that reality played out?
I think I should just give you some context, right? It is not that at 20 people are kind of figuring out, but I'll tell you what was happening in my life then. I was pretty aimless as a 20-year-old.
Okay.
I was doing engineering, but my heart was not into it.
Okay.
And the level of effort I was putting into it was matching my level of interest. It was both very low. And as luck would have it, I don't know whether my sister or my cousin, somebody was reading this book, which they had left behind at home, and I chanced upon it.
Okay.
It was the autobiography of Lee Iacocca.
Okay.
Now, Lee Iacocca is a legendary business figure, but quite old. But he was a titan in the automobile industry in the US. He was president of Ford, got sacked, got fired, went to Chrysler, which was facing a lot of problems. He turned that company around. But somewhere reading through that autobiography, something clicked in my mind.
Okay.
And I started being fascinated with the journey of the man and the kind of, and the whole thing about managing a business, right? And running a business. Nobody in my family has run a business, so it's all from a services background. I mean, I don't mean army, navy like that, but private service, like working in companies. So I had no exposure to that. So my early exposure about understanding a business was reading that book. And something clicked. And that is when I thought, okay, this is a career that I would like to pursue. Okay. And once you start developing interest in something, then automatically your level of effort, et cetera, starts increases. To increase, go up, right?
Yeah.
So it's very clear I wanted to then do an MBA because that was a journey to, and all of that. To come back to your question of how the journey has been, it's probably been more fulfilling, rewarding, and more enjoyable than what I ever thought.
Okay.
Right? Somewhere along the line, while I started my career working in large companies like Unilever, I was very clear sometime midway through my career that I wanted to work in a smaller company, be a much larger fish in a smaller pond, do a lot more things, do more impactful stuff. And so somewhere I transitioned into, and I was also very, very fascinated about digital technologies, telecom, all of that. Yeah. And since then, I think I've really enjoyed my career over the last 15 years or so.
No, you've been at the helm of, I think, InfoEdge, Siksha, Jeevan Sathi, where very early days digital tech startups, right? In fact, on that line, Prakash, you've seen this cycle. I think you've been one person who's not seen it from the sidelines, but been there and done it, right? 15 odd years, digital tech ecosystem, you know, scale some of these companies, now Redbus, part of an IPO company. From your vantage point, how has the ecosystem evolved in this sense? From a talent lens, but do you see it evolving or changing, or still more or less remain the same?
No, there's been a massive change. Massive change. When I first started contemplating moving into, let's say, the more younger companies and all of that, I was fortunate to join InfoEdge, which had already gone public.
Yes.
So that's the OG of the Indian startup world. It had already gotten public and it had very, very robust balance sheet, very profitable. Mm. And I was being paid market salary. Right? But before my movement from Unilever to InfoEdge, I had to take a salary cut, right? Because these were not the times when companies had, you know, millions of dollars of funding. In general, they were less glamorous. I don't think anyone had heard of something called a unicorn. So these were all pretty new. So the environment has tremendously changed, right? And for the better. I think there is a lot more talent that comes into the industry now. I think we've got the best people now thinking of working in startups or becoming founders. And some of the things that we're building in India are truly world-class, which wasn't the case earlier, right? We were finding our way. We were probably a bit less professional. The intent and the aspiration was there. But our capabilities were, you know, still getting developed. Mm. But over time, I think with the growth of this ecosystem, the kind of funding that has come in, the kind of inspirational founders who have, you know, kind of made it big here. Today we, I guess, attract the cream of the talent.
Yeah.
And that has really helped us a lot. Yeah.
I can't imagine the changes you can see in 15 years. I remember when I took up Redbus, with all due respect, my father was very upset. I think I told you that, right? Yeah. He said, "You're leaving a services company, you're going to sell bus tickets." And I said, "No, we're not selling bus tickets." But we were literally selling bus tickets, right? So from that journey to now, I think what a journey.
And that too, you were kind of moving from TCS, right?
Yes, large
like
ecosystem.
Like the TCS, Tata, big group.
But the joke is, my father still would carry that my TCS business card and not my Red Bus, which had a higher designation, by the way. But thank you for taking that punt on someone who had no freaking clue of what startup was all about. I still don't know. I don't think, and I keep telling, had I had to make an entry to startup at this point, I don't think I would have made the cut, because the talent density is really, really high at this point in time, right? So great.
But you know, talking about that, right? For people who are thinking about moving from a much larger company, working in MNCs, large companies, and moving to a startup, right? I'll just narrate a story, which was kind of eye-opening for me.
Okay.
So this was when I was interviewing with Sanjeev Bikhchandani
yeah.
and Hitesh Oberoi.
Yeah.
They are both the co-founders Correct. Of InfoEdge. And this was when I was talking to them about joining and taking on the role at Shiksha, which was a 0-to-1.
Yes.
Something was in place, but there was no business within InfoEdge. And I remember asking that, you know, so what is the expectation from me, right? You know, if I take on, what is the kind of business that you're expecting me to build? What is the revenue plan?
Yeah.
And both of them kind of looked at each other. And then Sanjeev looked at me and said, boss, if you join, yeah. we hope you can tell us what is going to happen. Do? Because we have no idea. We just think there's an opportunity.
Yeah.
And for me, coming from Unilever, where I kind of cut my teeth in corporate yeah. world, having spent, you know, 7.5 years. If you say for something that the answer is, I don't know. There is something seriously wrong, right? You are supposed to know all the answers. Even if, I mean, exaggerating a little bit, but if somebody says, hey, how much of this SKU will we sell in the modern trade channel 3 years from now? You are supposed to have some number,
right?
But here, so it was quite refreshing. Huh. And I figured that, look, the level of ambiguity
huh.
is super high, right? You don't know. There is no product. You have to kind of create something. Nothing exists. You have to first conceive of the value and create it and make it happen. And it may or may not happen.
Yeah.
Right? So the ambiguity is high. And so for anyone looking to move from a, yeah. let's say, more traditional, more established kind of corporate life into a startup, even today, right?
Yeah.
I think their comfort with ambiguity needs to be quite high.
True. No. And I think, Prakash, one thing I'll add that even this is not at your time, but 2015 when I moved, right? I remember at that time, only your intent and your interest and your motivation to join a startup was good enough to differentiate. Because not too many people wanted to move, yeah. right? So if you are somebody, oh, I'm excited and I want to do, it was differentiation enough and then hard work and all of it. Here now, only because you're interested and you're excited will not differentiate anymore. Because I think startup ecosystem has evolved to the extent that you still need some amount of base on which scale can be built, right?
The bar for hiring has gone up very high, a lot more. Yeah,
for all the good reasons. Great. Prakash, Redbus, you know, founders exit for whatever they've built, an amazing product, right? But it's still always one of the biggest challenges to take over a founder CEO, especially when you have a legacy of a product and a business and a legacy of a team, right? While you had worked with the mammoth of the brands, HUL, Airtel, you've learned from the InfoEdge ecosystem. Just give us, help us understand how this particular transition play out for you, right? Taking over a legacy and taking it to scale.
My overlap with the founding team of at Redbus was for 2 weeks.
Yes.
Right? A lot of time there. Funny, amazing guy, built a great business. Became a father, I think the day or the next day that I joined. So he was on paternity leave for much of that time. And I think somewhere, right, if I were to look back in hindsight, there have been so many stories where, I don't like the word professional CEOs, not like other people are not professional. Let's say non-founder CEOs, right? When non-founder... Yeah.
Yes.
CEOs take over.
Yeah.
And the founders continue in the company.
Correct.
That is where there could be potentially room for more conflict because the teams are used to getting direction from someone. And unless and until there's a lot of maturity in the way they deal with each other and clear separation of roles, etc., this can prove to be kind of, you know, counterproductive, can lead to issues. In my case, if I were to look back, it wasn't that much of a challenge because the founding team were moving on, right? So I got that, therefore, a kind of a clean slate to start off from. And the circumstances were such that a lot of the other leadership team also had moved on for various reasons.
Yes, yes.
Right? So it was not just a clean slate for myself, even in terms of, by virtue of, there not being other senior people around, I also had the...
No other option. But
no other option and the... good fortune in some
sense
to build my own team, right? But having said that, it was important for the credibility, not just for me, but all the people who were kind of coming into the company, that the existing team, because they were a supremely motivated bunch of people, right? They were the people who had joined the early days of the startup.
They all, a lot of them are still
many
there.
Many of them, yeah. And they believed in the mission of what Redbus was doing. And they had seen all this turmoil at the top. And so they wanted belief, right? That things are going to turn around for the better. So one of the first things that, again, in hindsight, when you're in the thick of things, you don't think of it that objectively, was to create a win for the company, an early win for the team, right? And in a platform like Redbus, which is a perishable inventory product, right? Having inventory freshness, how fresh is the inventory that you're getting from the suppliers, becomes of paramount importance. And our inventory system, like that of a startup, was built over time, had not scaled, a lot of patchwork of code written on top. So it was not very scalable and there was a lot of issues, right? So my first market visit, literally people were told me in as many words that your product doesn't work. They were alleging that you're taking money from you're taking money from my competition and you're not showing my, displaying my inventory. All of those kind of stuff. Very little confidence in the supply team. So I joined in June. I remember in July, we had a meeting with the regional heads, the supply team regional heads, who interact with bus operators on a day-to-day basis. And I told them that, look, come August 15th, you will have independence and freedom from all these issues related to inventory. And the reason I said that was that the tech team had already identified this as a problem and they were already working on it. So I put a lot of my personal energy and kind of, you know, getting people, telling people, hyping it up, saying that this is a big change that is going to come up. And lo and behold, August 15th came along.
It worked.
And like any good tech project, it doesn't get delivered on time, right? I mean, it's but natural because it's such a complex thing and we have to be doubly sure and all that. But we hit early September and that was one of the only days or one of the few days I remember in my life where I really prayed hard. In fact, down the road, if you recall, there is a temple that comes, you know, past Udipi. I actually, before we made it, took it to production, I thought I should go and, you know, because it is so much of us riding on that.
Correct.
Right? And it worked.
Oh my God.
So it worked. Our success rates improved dramatically. All thanks to Anoop, who you know is a CTO for Redbus and his lieutenants, Manoj, chiefly amongst them. And that worked. And that worked not just for like improving the success rates for customers, but suppliers got a lot of confidence that, hey, these guys have fixed something. The supply team took confidence.
Okay, yeah.
Conversion rates went up. So for product managers, it's like a tailwind. So whatever else they did, the fundamental reliability having gone up means that there was more ROI for their effort. The marketing team started getting transactions at lower cost because conversion rates went up.
Overall confidence,
so, so overall for the organization, right? The fact that, okay, something changed for the better and decisively so was one way in which we were able to kind of, you know, get credibility and that early win is always important to establish yourself, right? So,
you know, in some way when you were telling the team got cleaned up and maybe, you know, very opportunistic on my part. I'm glad that happened because then you hired me to build the team. But Prakash, I know and, you know, I keep telling a piece of my heart still stays there. But a lot of people that we build, you know, we hired all the entire leadership team, Manoj and the likes, everybody who came, right? A lot of them are still in the firm. I think if the leadership team tenure on an average is what, 8 to 10 years or more, if I'm not wrong, right? And it's not one or two person. I know people who stayed on after the founder's exit are still there in the firm, a lot of them. People who you hired in that first year are still there in the firm, right? Taking up big leadership roles. What has been your hack? How has this, and this is a mammoth of an organization now, right? What have you done? What was the magic thing that you did that all of them, you know?
Again, only I'm just speaking from hindsight, right? I think more than hiring, right? And I'm not taking away any credit from you, Rupali, because the fact that people are all there and done so well is credit to the hiring team. But I guess the longevity, right, is because of the fact that somewhere the values of the people that came in matched with what we were building.
Correct.
And also it helps the fact that, you know, business has been growing.
Hmm.
So if you were to look at when Redbus got acquired by Naspers in 2013, roughly it was about 600 crores of GMV, right? We will end this year, you know, about 20x of that number, right? Over a span of 10, 11 years, with 3 years of COVID, right?
Correct. That came which in. Which was completely...
Where it hit our business tremendously, right? So one, the fact that the business kept growing meant that people continuously kept getting challenged being challenged, and, you know, with growth comes complexity. So that helped. Second is around just building a culture where I was very clear from my standpoint that, look, now this is no longer a founder-led company.
Yeah.
Now, when you're a founder or an owner-led company, a lot of times people look up to say that, look, somebody give me direction, or the final buck kind of stops there. Or in general, you know that it belongs to somebody. Somebody cares for the organization more than anybody else. And maybe that's a feeling there. But here, given that we didn't have any one such person, I tried telling the people. In fact, every time we do our induction immersion programs for new joiners, I make it a point to say that, look, there is no one founder here.
Yes.
So there's no one owner. So we are all co-owners. In fact, one of the artifacts that we have in our office is a wheel that keeps rotating, right? It says that there are no backseat passengers here. Everybody is a co-driver, right? So that giving people the sense of ownership in an environment where you are also kind of the innovator in the category because we were not playing catch up or we're not copying somebody else because we were kind of thinking from first principles, solving things which are fundamentally needed for the market. That also keeps the challenge quotient high.
Yeah.
And the fact that growth came in as a reward. Right? I think all of these things possibly has come together to make it happen. But the underlying thing, I think, is the match in values.
Got it.
Because we also had if you were to cast your mind back, we also had some exits in the early days. Not maybe of people that we hired, but people were already there in the company. And those exits happened because of a mismatch in values.
Correct.
Or mismatch in the cultural affinity.
Oh, yeah. At hindsight, everything looks very thoughtful, mindful, right? There's a lot of wisdom. But when you look back now, Prakash, what were some of the mistakes?
Many.
Yes, the top one.
So just from a people standpoint, right? I think sometimes, and that is a learning for me, that sometimes the grass appears greener on the other side, right? So like they say, ghar ki murgi dal barabar. So you tend to underappreciate the people who are there, right? So because you know you work closely with them, you know their pluses and minuses. Whereas when you meet people, let's say offline in some event, or you interact with somebody for a short period of time, or even an interview, people are putting their best foot forward. So you tend to see only the gloss.
Correct.
So my learning from those mistakes have been that, look, you need to trust your people a lot more. And therefore, when there are opportunities for growth, right? It should first ideally go to people within the company, as in, rather than getting someone from outside, look to give people that chance, empower them, trust them, even if it means that there are things that they need to pick up, especially for people who have a track record, right? So I think that's one key learning, that where mistakes get made. Then hiring can often go wrong. So we have had instances where we have not had the best fit, and we have had people moving on, or we had to have a separation. So hiring mistakes happen. And I can talk about what has been some of the learning, etc. from there. But like on hiring, right? Sometimes it's just bad luck. You may do everything, X, Y, Z thing right, and yet some things may go wrong. But if I were to critically evaluate, right? One thing, and what as a result of that, what we have done, we make sure that we stick to the process. And it's sometimes painful, which means that if I'm hiring somebody who's reporting to me, I'll make sure that I'll jot down what are the skill sets that I need to see in the candidate.
Hmm.
And then the hiring panel that I will identify for that role,
hmm.
it's a common hiring panel that will see all the candidates.
Okay.
And then sometimes, because in a 1 hour interview, 1.5 hour interview, you may not end up checking all the boxes, right?
Yeah.
So I'll tell the other person that, you know, look, I haven't tested on this aspect. And then we have
there is consistency.
Consistency.
Also,
yeah. And then we, after every interview, the panel gets together, talks,
hmm.
and I make it a point to give my opinion the last, because hmm. I don't want to color what people are thinking.
Yeah.
So I will.
Okay.
So these are
yes.
you know, small, deliberate actions, but I think getting that viewpoint, common viewpoint, getting candid viewpoints become important.
Hmm.
The second thing is culture, which I told you, right? Because where we've had some separation, etc., was where there is a cultural mismatch. And therefore, you need to know, in our case, I'm very clear what are the cultural nuances of our organization.
Hmm.
And if somebody comes across in an interview where it seems like they are a cultural misfit, right? Then even though they check the box on a lot of skills, that's a conversation. And typically at senior level hiring, the people have in the panel are also kind of trained, or they have also over time, they also understand, they're also culturally quite adept at figuring out, you know, who can fit in, who cannot. So that's an important parameter. The third thing, which I think I can't, to my mind, that becomes very critical, is ref checks.
Yeah.
And ref checks are not on what the candidate has given you.
Blind.
But you have to take the effort to reach out to people through your network, etc., to get a candid ref check on the candidate.
Yes.
And I'll tell you where I've gone wrong.
Yeah.
Because you've put in so much of investment in getting the candidate through that process. You've met so many people, you've shortlisted, everybody has liked. You're somewhere willing in your hearts for the ref check to be positive.
Positive.
Right? So when you talk to the person, you're just latching on to all the things that
you want
are
to
positive.
Hear. Yeah.
And sometimes you ignore, you know, what they are really trying to say.
Correct.
Because somebody has worked, very few people are going to be very candid to say, look, don't hire over, unless there's an integrity issue, right? So people will give you like a mixed feedback. But it's very important to tune into what they are saying. And one killer question in my mind is that, look, if you had an opportunity, would you rehire the person, right, in your team? And that often tells you when people, if somebody says, you know, jiffy that, yes, absolutely. Then that is something. But if somebody says, but depends on X, Y, Z.
Mm.
And not missing those signals have come to, you know, bite me in the back.
Yes.
Right? Where somebody gave a feedback and then you find, after 6 months, after 8 months, that, okay, I'm seeing these behaviors, which
somebody had
mentioned before, right? So I think these are some of the learnings in terms of, you know, where...
In fact, we also do a lot. We call it blind reference checks. In fact, we have a podcast on this.
Mm.
And I might be wrong, and please feel free to correct me otherwise. With scale, also has its own, you know, highs and lows. The highs being business is growing, higher revenue, you know, more opportunities. But also many a time, there is some amount of lethargy built in, right? Because you've done that again and again and what more.
Mm.
So at this point in time, the team, which is vintage, has a lot of historical context, but also has gone through a 10 years of shift in their career, right?
Mm.
How do you ensure that the team is still agile, motivated to do the next big thing every day?
Yeah. Look, this is at two levels, okay?
Yeah.
One is at a level of saying that, are we doing the kind of things that continue to excel and challenge people, right? And there, I guess, it's all about innovation. It's all about knowing deeply your customers. And so I'll give you an example, right? When we were, let's say, doing something 5 years ago, we would do it at an en masse level at a product, because even there were gaps to be filled there, right?
Mm.
But now we are extremely granular.
Mm.
When we do, let's say, sorting to improve conversion rates, right? There are different customer cohorts. So the sort is not one single fit for all. It's very, very, of course, personalization is there. But even without personalization, we have very, very different things operating at different customer cohort levels. One, because with the data, we have got the mind space to investigate, understand, study the data, and therefore take... like marketing, we have become very regional in our approach.
Mm.
Earlier it was like, Spray and Pray, really? One campaign, Pan India, get a celebrity. But now we are very thoughtful, very deliberate about what we are doing. These are some things, but also expansion, right? Mm. So doing a new business line, expanding into a new country, geography, new products within your core business itself. These keep the energy levels going, right? The other is at an individual level, right? So this is at an overall business level. At an individual level, I'm a big believer in something called flow, right? People talk about flow in the context of sports people, that when you're in flow, you play really well and you're like...
Yeah.
And flow tends to happen when somebody's skills and capabilities, right? They match perfectly with the kind of challenges and that they're facing, right? Yeah. The kind of problems that they're handling. If you're... skills and capabilities are much beyond or much better than the kind of challenges that are being given, then you tend to go into the comfort zone, right? And then you are kind of lax. That is when things like lethargy, etc., because you're just being in the comfort zone. If it's the other way around, where the level of challenge is being thrown is much higher than the capabilities, then people get into the anxious phase, right? Now, it's okay. For some time, it's good to make people, provided with they've got the skill sets to then improve their skills and get to that flow, right? So somewhere it's also about knowing where people are and then matching them with increased responsibilities. In some cases, the growth itself has provided enough challenge because the roles have expanded, people's team sizes have grown, complexity has gone up. In some cases, it's about giving them more things as part of their portfolio, right? So they are spending time on newer things, especially on 0-1 kind of problem statements. They are devoting a lot of time there. In some cases, it could be a role change.
Okay.
Where people were doing a role and they have completely moved to a different role. Right? And there are examples of all of them.
Oh, yes. I know the third one is prevalent. Great.
I mean, you did both.
Yes.
You got additional responsibility.
I remember once you told me about a role and I responded, is it an April Fool joke? I remember that.
You moved from, like, in addition to your HR recruitment role, you started getting into tech project management.
We built that Scrum team and all of it. So quite interesting. Prakash, I can't ask you to summarize so many years of learning. But still, if I have to nudge you to give us that one hack, one framework that you've always gone back to whenever you had always had to balance criticality of a business, right? Plus ensuring you build the right team for that, right? How have you balanced? What is the framework that you use to balance business needs versus people's need?
Look, there are 2-3 principles that govern it, right? One is, and to answer, to connect back to your earlier point about as an organization becomes large, how do you still be nimble and agile? So our organizational design is based on having a lot of, you know, smaller teams that are self-contained, right? Now, what this means is that it is probably not the most efficient way.
Okay.
Because there'll be some slack. But where it kind of helps the overall cause is that people are not waiting on. People feel like, say, a product manager is kind of running a pod or a track. He has all the resources needed to execute and deliver the story. And therefore, the empowerment and the at a lower levels helps in getting velocity and speed to market. Otherwise, you're dependent on somebody else deciding who will get allotted to the project, etc. Right? So, having a tracks, kind of pods or tracks, as we call it, which are more aligned to the business problem or a particular business unit.
Okay.
Broken down, if there's a large business unit, it'll be for, like, you know, specific aspects.
Okay.
That has helped.
Okay.
And then somewhere on the efficiency question, right? It is about stepping back and seeing that, look, over the last 6 months, if we have got these pods and tracks, what have they delivered, right? What has been the output? And today, it's a bit more qualitative in terms of saying that what is the impact that has been created? And if we find that, look, that has been a bit low and the future product roadmap or the product backlog is not strong enough, then we end up disbanding that pod and then reallocating it. And then to figure out ultimately the larger cost is on dev resources, right? So there it is about having some framework to say that, look, if there's a product person, then how many typically engineers and how many QA people are needed in order to make that pod. So typically we have, for every product manager, we'll have about 7 to 8 devs and maybe 2 to 3 QA.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
That's how we've kind of figured out the team sizing and all of that.
But still very, very agile. I think, you know, it's been all more or less the numbers, you know, while the business revenue has grown, the team has more or less stayed, the number of people have stayed same.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of efficiencies have come up over time as well. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. For the next section, Prakash, I have a couple of rapid fires for you. You initially said, and I want you to be very, very honest, right? You said, you know, new generation of founders happening, right? Anyone new generation founder that you admire?
I think I'm quite impressed with Dipinder at Zomato.
Yes.
Purely because at Info Edge, while I was there, that is when the investment into Zomato happened. It was called Foodie Bay back in those days.
Correct.
And what was basically a food classified or a menu discovery platform.
Correct.
To have been able to seize the opportunity and grow it into like a $25-30 billion dollar business has been quite remarkable. And despite having gone through multiple ups and downs and near death experiences, having scaled international, then wanted back with making the big bet on Blinkit. So I've been quite, from a India perspective, amazed at the growth of Zomato.
Likewise. No, great. Your leadership style when you started versus now?
Frankly, I don't think much has changed.
Okay.
I guess I'm able to now lean into different aspects of what is needed.
Yeah.
Earlier, probably had a more singular style of operation.
So you customize now.
So a bit more customization is coming. Like I was saying, you customize what customer cohorts need.
So personalization.
Personalization,
style,
figuring out what needs to be told to somebody else. Therefore, So I think leadership style, while you have a base who you are, right? Hmm. Leadership style is very, very linked to that. You can't you can't try and be somebody else. Hmm. Right? But I think the situation leadership also matters. Somewhere I think you need to be authoritarian leader when it needed.
Hmm.
My largest style is more building consensus. Hmm. But I think you need to be assertive, authoritarian when needed.
Yeah.
And if some teams are absolutely doing a fabulous job and they are, then let them be, right? So,
Got it. And what is that one cardinal sin while interviewing at Redbus?
If you were to end up talking yourself up a lot, right? Then I think that would be a sin.
Bummer. Okay. Yeah. Okay, fair. What's your favorite app apart from Redbus?
Right now, I'm fascinated by all these GenAI apps.
Okay.
And I think there's a reason why ChatGPT is up there because I think it's the best of the lot. Yeah, so I'm trying to use ChatGPT in various ways to see how I can improve my own personal productivity.
Okay.
So I'm finding
that
fascinating.
You discovered some hack?
Multiple.
I'm going to catch up with you offline.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. If you were, you could switch your role with anyone in Redbus for one day, who would that be?
Anyone in Redbus?
Uh-huh.
I think with a customer service agent.
So,
because
and why?
It'll be good to just listen to customer feedback in a very focused manner and try to understand, you know, problems at a very micro level.
Yeah.
And really understand what are the pain points of customers and stuff like that. Yeah. So
if you have enjoyed listening to the podcast as much as I have enjoyed hosting it, and you see value in some of these learning, please show us some love. Subscribe to our podcast.